Yeah, you and I have talked a little bit in the past about, I think you call it like the beast, inside of you. And I'm wondering, man, turning the beast on and off, what does that entail? And like, can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, it's, if you're going to, or potentially going to inflict extreme violence against other human beings, there has to be a very aggressive side of yourself, akin to without the aggression of your brother. Hey, I have the surgical tools in my hand. It is my duty to save this person's life. I have to perform right now, right? He's removing a cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Not to dehumanize the enemy, but in the same token, that ideology is a cancer.
Mm-hmm.
I have to remove that cancer. Mm-hmm. Right, I have to apply a scalpel to that.
Mm-hmm.
Not a big old sledgehammer, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not going to create a big wide swath of a mess here.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to apply that.
Mm-hmm.
And one tool is aggression,
mm-hmm.
right? But if that's sustained for too long, that's going to damage the human being. You know what I mean? So being able to turn that off and recenter yourself,
mm-hmm.
Is something that I think that the individuals have to discover is, mm-hmm. what tools do you use to turn the human being back on? Initially it was nature, you know, spending a lot of time with the ocean, underwater, spearfishing or diving. It was complete silence. I could feel like I was flying through the kelp forest, surfing. I found a lot of peace with family and friends at the kitchen, in the kitchen, preparing food, and having that community. Even though I didn't feel as necessarily close to my own family as I did to my teammates at the mm-hmm. time, because of the experiences I had. And then just knowing that at some point what I was trying to do wasn't working. And by making myself vulnerable to other people that could help me navigate, where I was in my life, and opening myself to receive care and help, was transformative. It was through other human beings that invested in veterans and different veterans group and law enforcement and firefighters that have experienced a tremendous amount of trauma in their lives. And having those shared experiences with those groups was incredible. I got to go out and escort and share space with a bunch of veterans, law enforcement, and firefighters at a program called Save a Warrior, which was in Ohio. And as an escort, and they said, "Hey, Kevin, do you want to sit through the indoctrination and the intake?" And I said, "I'd love to."
Yeah,
you know, hold space for other people. And then going through this process, I really loved what I was hearing. And in the process, you know, they kind of surprised me and said, "You want to stay for the week?" And I got to stay for the week. And it was incredible because, you know, one of the sacraments there was about, you know, there's so much shame and guilt applied to being vulnerable for a man in today's society. And they explained to you the physiological effects of hyperfocus, hypervigilance, hyperaggressions for sustained periods of time. The brain changes. How do we create balance? Well, there's tools that we can use like meditation, but there's also methods to heal. And tears are an incredible vessel
sure.
in that process. Just to sit and watch men be vulnerable with yep. one another, to share their trauma and to exercise that. I mean, John, one of the most profound experiences I've had in my life. There's a gentleman that sat in a circle that grew up in an abusive home,
mm-hmm.
Physically, sexually, mentally abusive home, with drug addicts. He decided to escape it, you know, failing out of high school, decided to escape it, joined the army, went overseas, lost a bunch of people in his unit, came home, in the process, lost his young son, to suffocating in the mm-hmm. crib, because his wife was on drugs at the time. And then, you know, and then contracted MS. So he's like, "I'm done." Yeah. Like, life just has not been fair to me.
Yeah.
He goes, and he shared with everyone. And he said, "Look, you know, I'm this is my last shot. Yeah. Like, I'm just letting you guys know.
Yeah.
But throughout the week, he put in every single effort as a human being to make himself as vulnerable as possible and just let go of that trauma and open up. And tears just all week poured out of this guy. And in the process, John, I watched his skin color change. I watched his eye color change. I watched his posture change. I watched him go through horse therapy.
Healing.
It was incredible.
Yeah.
Like, it was metamorphosis.
Yeah.
And the love and support that he received from the staff members and the shepherds that were there and then from the group. And it was all because he just made himself vulnerable and he needed help and he asked for help and he received the help and he received the love.
Why don't we recognize that as the courage that takes? That is such a struggle. It takes so much courage to do that.
Ancient cultures knew this. Before our ancient warriors, whether they were Native Americans, naked Greek warriors, you know, before men came home from war, there were rituals that they had to go through exercising those demons because society and the civilization knew that if you didn't provide a platform for this trauma that they experienced to be exercised, right, then they would bring that home. And the community, the communal qualities of that civilization depended on the health of these men.
Right.
And so what rituals do we have in place now? Well, you can board the plane first. Hey, everyone in the stands, the baseball game, stand up and celebrate our veterans. It's not doing anybody any good.
Right.
You know, hey, it just takes space and it takes that ear. It takes listening. It takes professional help, but it takes love. You take a plant. If a plant's dying in the corner because it doesn't have sunlight or water, what do you do with it? Put it in the sunlight. You give it water. You're going to love it. You're going to take care of it. Right. You foster dogs, right?
Yeah.
You're going to put them in a better environment. What does love do?
Yep.
Brings them right back. So when men talk about love, once again, people are going to confuse it with weakness and or kindness or soft spot. And once you spend a little bit more time in your heart and you make yourself available to other people and you invest in other people, your happiness just grows exponentially.
Yeah, man. But like, Kev, I think it really is going to take, you know, it is really going to take, I think, men like yourself, you know, and people that, everyone's got these traumas, and there's so many fucking forces at play that tell you to keep that shit bottled up and judgments. And I feel, again, it's this rah-rah chest beating bullshit, fake projection of strength from people who haven't actually been in the models aren't out there, man. What would have happened with you in the UFC? Is that an interest of you?
You know what? I don't know. The three times I approached them, once in 97, they offered me $150,000 for 10 fights. I was like, are you fucking kidding me? $15,000 a fight? You want me to plaster my brains for $15,000?
Yeah.
So, and that was the best deal they gave. Yeah. This is back when they were struggling. This is before Dana. When Dana came in, I started getting my attention in 2001, 2002, and I was like, this is becoming huge.
Yeah.
Like, Dana White's doing an incredible job with this. Yeah. So in 2003, I decided I was going to do it.
Is that around the same time Brock came?
Brock was, I think, right around then, 04, because he tried out for the Steelers. Maybe 04, 05, Brock was UFC. Yeah. He tried out for the Vikings, I'm sorry, in 03. But in 03, I broke my neck. Brock broke my neck.
Oh, shit.
And there was no way I was going to, you know, I lost feeling in my hands. I lost about 50% strength in my arms. My arms used to be 20 inches. They're 14 and a half now. I've lost 5.5 inches from atrophy from my neck. So I wouldn't have done well. I did contact him in 2006, and by then I couldn't even do 8 push-ups. That's bad my upper body was.
Wow.
I would have gotten crushed.
Wow.
And so Dana offered me a great deal. He wanted me to do one deal was one fight. He wanted to give me $7 million, but he wanted me to sit in the crowd for 7 years. And he wanted me to fight once and be kind of an ambassador.
Huh.
It was a great deal, but I just left WWE, signed with TNA, and Dana said, you can't be with a wrestling company, too. You're either with me or you're not. I said, well, I just signed with TNA. I can't do it, so maybe I'll come back to you. I did in 2010. I came back again. Dana offered me a 6-fight deal then. And I started training really hard for it, and I didn't have it. I got caught in an arm bar, and I couldn't even defend myself. It was my, it just wasn't, so I called Dan. I said, I can't do this. He wanted me to go on Real Fighter with Kimbo. And the cool thing is he was going to pay me $1 million to be on the show, because you go on the show, you don't get any money.
Right.
But Dana said, I'll give you $1 million to be on the show, and then I'll give you the six-fight deal worth this much money. Wow. So he was really – Dana was cool. He didn't –
And
you know,
didn't, and you didn't want to do that?
I just – I would have gotten hurt. I would have gotten
and
hurt.
What about your striking game? I mean, was that – would that
– It was getting better.
It was getting better?
I was really happy with that. I was horrible at kicking, so that wasn't going to work.
Yeah.
But my jiu-jitsu got better. Yep. And – You know, my base was wrestling, and I felt comfortable on top. Uh-huh. So, you know, but I trained hard for it, but I couldn't. I knew that if I would have competed, I would have got my ass handed to me.
Yeah,
it's because
just the injury. It was just your body was.
I can't feel this finger or this finger. Right. I mean, it's my motor skills are really bad. I can't touch my fingers together.
Wow.
Like I have really bad. I have to work on it every day. I have neck traction, anti-gravity, yoga, everything. Yeah. I work 3 hours, work out 3 hours a day.
Wow.
Keep my body healthy, not even in shape, healthy.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. It's funny, man, with the MMA, we talk about it all the time, man, with them, because, you know, like now, you know, young kids are growing up, you know, learning, you know, three different martial arts and stuff like that.
I know.
I mean, it used to be like in a street fight, man. It's like, man, if you could throw some punches,
and
you were lethal,
you were proud
to
be from that discipline. Like when UFC started, it was like, karate versus wrestling and boxing versus jiu-jitsu. Now it's like they're all together.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. That's right.
I thought it was cooler back then. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
I thought
it was more
pretty,
interesting, right? And
yeah, because you took pride in what discipline you were.
That's right.
It was like, I'm a wrestler and I'm a boxer.
That's right. And wrestlers really were did great.
Yeah, they've always done pretty well. Yeah. They get caught every once in a while, but they do extremely well in MMA.
Yeah.
Rumor is 61% of the athletes are wrestlers.
Yeah.
I believe it.
Yeah, I do too. I mean,
what is one story about my father-in-law that you think what is one story that I've
all
never
right,
heard?
I'll tell you. I think told you this.
And time. Again, man, anything that you say, we don't have. You know what I mean? But like, I mean, I know there was like one that it was like maybe like time he got like stabbed up and got put in that car or something. Like his lore?
All right.
What is
this? Well, the one where he got stabbed, he actually fought five guys and one of them stuck a knife. One of them, Mark grabbed him the double leg and got him up in the air, and his arm came down and got him in the intestines.
Yeah, that's what
his intestines were popping out. Like he was gonna die.
But I really, I mean, I remember like our cat was always in heat, but I don't really have. I mean, I was just so fucking, you know, self-centered, and like I was like a struggling, broke, failing fucking actor who could not get a break, and I was totally self-centered.
You know, the careers people choose and their training and what they go through to get there is all about what tolerance for what type of hardship, like what challenge is your personality allow itself to? What are you willing to take on? And so, you know, if you want to be an actor, like you deal with a lot of uncertainty and you're willing to take on the hard work and the not knowing that if you do A, it will lead to B. That's an uncertainty that like that I can't deal with that.
Yeah.
I went through my whole life knowing if I do A, I get B. If I do B, I get C. You know, you get that grade, you get into that place, you get into that place, you get that degree. And so I never had a day where I thought, man, what if I do all this and it doesn't work out?
Right.
That's not a skill set you need in medicine.
Right.
There's a really big difference in my mind and about like what makes good and great doctors and how you tease that apart. And this is something that, you know, I remember one of the guys at my program where I trained used to always say, never let your patients see you eating. Never let your patients see you eating.
Why?
Your patients do not want to see you as a human being.
Yeah.
They want to see you as their doctor. Like, go eat somewhere else, go hide in a corner, doesn't matter. But your patients don't want to know your troubles. They don't want to know your home life. Yeah. They don't want to know. And it was just this thing. He would put on his mask, his cape, whatever it is, every day when he got to work. And he was like, I am supposed to be this to be a doctor. I think that you can be a really good doctor that way. I do think it's hard to be a great doctor that way. Huh. I think you have a level of engagement with your patients that helps you get over, that allows you to be connected to them in a way that really helps what you do. And trying to find that line between engagement and enough disengagement that you can stay sort of cognitively on the right track and mm-hmm. you can stay objective-ish in your mm-hmm. decision-making. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, if you can't take on some of the emotional tie to being connected to them, you can make a scientifically correct decision mm-hmm. that is not a medically correct decision. And to some degree, I mean, everybody's got to draw their line where they draw their line. You know, like I have kids who die from their cancers, and I can't let that, no matter how much it eats at me, mm-hmm. I can't let that not allow me to go in and do the best job or to change decision making. So I got to learn from anything that's happened in my past, mm-hmm. but I can't, there are times that you do everything right. And cancer, you can do the best surgery in the world and take out the cancer, kid's doing great. 3 months later, the cancer shows up in their lungs and that kid dies. And you sit there and rethink all of the yeah. decisions you made along the path. Was it worth it to do that surgery? Did I put that kid through more pain than he needed? Was he gonna die without that surgery? Could I have avoided that? Mm-hmm. What? And, but the next kid who walks in, you have an obligation to sit there and try to go through it with them and make the best decision and not let, you know, not say, man, my last kid died after right. I did this surgery. That's just not a choice you have.
Right, right.
And so
right.
you divorce yourself from that. But I don't know, man. I mean, it goes back to the bigger picture. Like I just I'm much more optimistic about how strong people are than I think a lot of our global narrative is right now. And unfortunately, we live in a world that like is all about trying to convince us that we're weak. And everybody is weak. Everybody needs stuff. Everybody is wronged. Everybody is.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And like the truth is I spend my life with people who are getting real tough news.
Yeah.
And people are extremely strong and families are strong. Kids are strong and resilient. And when you can frame that we are aligned in this, I'm going to give you everything I have. But we're aligned in this, and I can't promise you. I'm not going to tell. Every kid walks in and says, first question, am I going to die from this? Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I can't tell you no, but I think we're going to beat this.
Fuck yeah.
And if I tell them you are not going to die from this,
yeah.
we're broken.
Yeah.
Like we're done.
To what extent do you think that there is like real currency of having a reputation as a police officer, as somebody who, if you want to go there, he will go there or she will go there. And also on the other side, like I've also seen, you know, guys on the streets, guys who are kind of career criminals, and like you guys have a mutual respect for each other. And how much of that is that currency of violence?
It's huge. I mean, it plays a big part. And right now, the turnover rate is so high in most departments that it's hard to build that type of rapport and reputation with people, which is another big thing. Like, you got to learn how to retain police, or else you can't have community policing if no one ever builds a rapport with people in the community.
Right.
And the door is revolving so fast now that there's not enough time for a lot of these officers to build rapports.
Right.
So, like, in me coming up, like, yeah, cops have reputations. Like, you know, even when you just pull onto the street and they see you,
everybody knows your
lifestyle
name.
Lifestyle changes, right? Yeah. Like, you know, they're like, oh shit, he's out. Be careful. Don't yeah. be stupid.
Yeah.
You know, you have nicknames. They give you yeah. nicknames yeah. or whatever. And you build a rapport. And look, if you're a shit cop, they're going to know it. They're going to call you out. Everyone's going to know it because the word's going to get out.
Yeah.
If you're good at your job, if you're like respectful, if you, you know, police right, that word gets out too. And people respect you and vice versa.
Yeah.
And again, it just comes down to having a mutual respect.
Yeah.
You know, understanding that it's not personal.
Yeah.
You know, they're not out there doing this to spite Anthony Maggio.
Right.
You know, they're
right.
out there selling drugs or doing whatever they're doing because that's just what they chose to do.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
minute you make it personal, you've lost.
Yeah.
You know, and you're going to lose yourself in that moment.
Yeah.
So I just think if you're out there and like if it gets aggressive and you have to fight and they see you can handle yourself, there's a lot less chance that someone will try you.
That's it.
Huge. Like if you get out there and a dude works you up and he takes all, like he throws you down and runs away from you, every person you try to lock up is going to throw you down and try to run away from you.
That's right.
Because they know they can do it.
Uh-huh.
But if they try that and you dump them or slam them or, you know, if they throw a punch and you know, your punch is faster, whatever the case may be, and they realize he ain't one to mess with.
Yeah.
They just don't do it.
Yeah.
You know, and look, you'll have the ones that will test you, and there's always a exception to them rules. But, yeah, if reputation is huge on both sides.
Yep.
You know, like, you know that there's some guys that you just can't calm down.
Right.
Like, if so-and-so comes up and starts running his mouth, the best thing to do is ignore him, because no matter what you say to him, you're never going to calm that dude down.
Right.
Because he's just being an ass. Right.
But that is community. But that is like having an intimate, like understanding who's who and who does what. And like, hey, look.
That's why this whole thing with like trying to sell the community policing model all across the country, you need retention to sell that model. Because if you're not retaining cops, and if these cops aren't in these neighborhoods longer than 6 months a year, they're not building rapport with the community.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? They're chasing call to call.
Mm-hmm.
Where do they have time to build a rapport? And then they quit, or go to another agency, go to another line of work, and you have a whole new set of cops that come in and try to do it.
Yeah.
So you're never building that rapport.
Yeah.
Where, like, I've worked in that same neighborhood pretty much most of my career.
Yeah.
You know, and I've been dealing with a lot of these guys since they were kids.
Yeah. And you grew up there.
Right. And like, the first guy I locked up, I grew up with.
Wow.
You know, like D, when I met D, we had a mutual friend that we knew growing up, you know, and it's like that dude poured a gun on me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, so it's like, yeah, that helps.
Yeah.
But even when I went to like the West Side for a little bit, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
If you just treat people a certain kind of way, it will repay itself.
Yeah.
You know, and not that you're looking for repayment, but it's just karma.
Yeah.
You know, it's just you treat people right. Like I told you a story when I got my car stuck in the mud when I was a young cop.
No.
So there was this dude. He was a big-time drug dealer. Uh-huh. And I was young, been patrol, had like 6 months on. You know, I was hard charging, whatever. And I used to always, like, try to get this guy. And I was brand new. I had no idea what the hell I was doing. Always making mistakes, you know, trying to get in a coat, like a vacant house and watching, making too much noise.
Yeah.
You know, whatever the case may be. Just always screwing it up.
Yeah.
And one day I'm like, I'm going to get this dude, right? I'm going to get his ass today.
Yeah.
Came out early in my car, and I went through the alley, and I was trying to park my car like two alleys down to sneak up on him, and I got stuck in the mud. And I'm back, and my wheels are spinning, and I'm revving the engine. I can't get out, man. And this was a big dude. I'm not going to put his name out there because I know I don't want to throw him out there like that, but he was a big guy, about 6'6", 350.
Yeah.
And his buddies and brothers were the same size.
Yeah.
And so as I'm back here trying to get my car out of this mud and the wheels are spinning, you know, I'm like, ah, man, this sucks. Him and his two buddies come walking into the alley. And they're huge. I mean, he's a big-ass dude.
Yeah.
And I'm like, damn. So I get out of my car. I'm like, what's up, man? He's like, what are you doing? I'm like, yeah, I got my car stuck. And he was like, you was trying to watch me, weren't you? And I was like, yeah, I was trying, but I fucked that up. You know what I mean? He's like, ah, man, we got you. And they pushed me. Those three big-ass dudes pushed me out of mud.
Wow.
And, you know, like at the moment, you really don't realize what it is. But as you get older, because I mean, I was 21, young, you know, you just realize what that meant.
Fuck yeah.
And here I am trying to put these dudes in jail. And they realize I don't know what the hell I'm doing because I'm brand new. And, you know, they went over there and pushed me out.
Mm.
You know, and that just, it shows a mutual respect.
That's it. I mean, the only thing we just said in the car coming back, right? You can't change people in this world. You know what I mean? You can only change yourself. You change yourself, you change the world. You know what I'm saying? And you know, I just think that that's kind of it. I like, tell me a little bit, Carter, like now you got a murder rate in this city. That's the highest. It just hit the record last night. So, I mean, now it's actually, you know, more dangerous out here than when he was on the streets. Do you feel that? Do you feel that every day?
Hell yeah, John. Like, they know I ain't going nowhere without my gun. Straight up, nowhere. I got it with me now. I ain't going nowhere without it. Just because you ain't even got to be on that type of time. It's just people just ignorant. Like, I got a partner just killed somebody. And he walking free. But it's like, when I ran in with him, he was like, people so crazy, bro. He don't even like talking about it because he tried to defuse the situation. You know what I'm saying? He was like, dude was just still hot-headed about the situation. When he trying, he not knowing that he got his kids and wife in the car. You know what I'm saying? And he got dudes still trying to get ignorant when you trying to resolve something. One thing go to another. You know what I'm saying? And it's just like that. Like, it could just be, it be anything, man. It's just, nowadays, it's just.
You feel it every day? Like, do you ask yourself every day?
I don't, like, I know, like, nothing coming toward me, but I don't want to be one of them people that at the wrong place, wrong time, or, you know what I'm saying? Or it's like that, you know what I'm saying? Like, I had just pulled off just from literally in front of one of my partners before he just got shot in the head.
While you were there?
I had just pulled off.
And you said they came at your block, like two times while you
Yeah. I remember when one time, and a baby got killed this night. My little sister had just graduated high school. We having a high school graduation for. Some little dude coming down the street. Just, you know, like I say, normal shootout, some cars shooting back to back. You know what I'm saying? We hear bullets, you know what I'm saying? We think people shooting at us. You know what I'm saying? But it's not even, wasn't even like that. You just you got everybody running, ducking the whole time. You got people running around shooting. You know what I'm saying? You never know, man. You never know. You might have seen somebody, people be on different time. You never know how somebody might be feeling them day. You know what I'm saying?
And you think, I mean, like, look, man, like, right now we, like, sitting here, right? And upstairs, I don't know what, there's 20 people up there. And let's be honest, like, we ain't naming any names because nobody can see who's up there right now. But there's killers here, right? Like, there's people who've had to kill, right? If you are, like, living in that, right, in that reality, day in and day out, if you're living around that all the time, that hardening is real, or do you think there's still some shit you haven't dealt with and you still get scared, you still get upset, you're still hurting? Like, does that go somewhere?
I think it's possible for somebody to become numb with it, especially somebody like Ricardo. If you grow up in that shit and you never get a chance to really suffer the consequences or none of that shit, you would feel invincible. And you would keep going, you know what I'm saying? And you would become numb to all of that shit. You'll think it's just normal life.
Yeah.
And that's how you can get hurt. That's one of my biggest fears, becoming numb to what's going on in this city. That means that I would go to any fucking gas station unaware. I'm not paying attention, none of that shit. But I always stay on point at all times. And I think a lot of people get hurt, man, because they become numb to thinking that it won't happen in certain spots or with certain people, you know what I'm saying? Yeah.
What's the kind of fear that you live with every day?
One of my biggest fears is not knowing the exact people that my kids deal with. You know what I'm saying? Because for every one person you deal with, I always say with me, man, the people that come around me, every time somebody come around me, I take on everything that they dealing with. Because if somebody looking for them and they want them bad enough, they don't give a fuck about me or nobody else. You know what I'm saying? So I have to monitor who come in my circle. And if you do come in my circle, I like to know exactly what's going on with you. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? I'd be a whole lot more comfortable if I knew exactly what was going on with you. If you come in my circle, I know you got beef with somebody else, then it ain't going to sit right with me.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to feel like it's some danger, not just to me, but to everybody else that's around me. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Yep.
I mean, do you think your future's here in Shreveport?
Hell nah, John. You know the answer to that question.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it could be, you know what I'm saying? It could be, like, I don't really see no future in Shreveport. I've been out of Shreveport, bro, a long time ago. Ain't nobody enjoying it. I think, like, it's all, everything out of, like, depression. You know what I'm saying? People, it's like, everybody got problems, you know what I'm saying? And people that's in it, like, a youngster like us, you either got his baby mama drama, you losing partners you see every day, you know what I'm saying? You got, it's just, everybody want money, but everybody's struggling, you know what I'm saying? You got, I don't know, man, it's really wild right now. It's just really wild right now.
I think part of what we're talking about here is like stigma, right? And that you're just hanging out with some guys on a block, whether whatever period of time of your life, but there have been people who have just been out on a block and that have been forced to be in these humiliating and painful situations for no reason whatsoever except for the color of their skin, the neighborhood they happen to be in. That's not fair, it's un-American, right? But at the same time, there's a stigma attached to police officers in general around this country. Whether you engage in that kind of behavior or not, you're made to feel like the enemy when you're also engaging in an unbelievably high-risk job. You've probably lost people that you care about the same way that you care about your homeboys. I know you've lost people and you've been shot at, and that feeling that's not fair. It exists on both sides of this.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, you see shit on the news and you see shit that's videotaped and you're like, fuck me, dude. It's coming. Now we're going to pay for this for months until the next incident happens. It's fucking business, man. It's not fucking personal. And when it goes over to that personal side, that's when you have problems. As you know, when it gets fucking personal, you got to remember, this is your job. Don't take shit personal. Mm-hmm. And once you cross that line, that's when it goes sideways.
That thing about not making it personal. I mean, what is the relationship between Newton and the Pueblos? Those two institutions were just sort of like set up.
Yeah, they like, seriously, and this is speaking from a lot of guys, and I talked to a lot of guys in the neighborhood. It was two separated institutions, like two separate. It was totally separated. You know, we felt like, at some point, as we got older and wiser, we knew that you come as a rookie, and if you get assigned to the Pueblos, you're going to move up. You get signed to that East Side, you're going to move up in rank. That was some of the stuff we were starting to pick up on and notice.
Why is that?
Shit like, because they just went over there and kicked ass. We feel like they pounded on us, over there. Not just the Pueblos, the villains and whatever else over there. That East Side, that whole East Side area, And it was like some statements made by other police, It kind of took us there to understand that,
Is there anything that you can remember that you've seen that you've, like, back in the day that you've respected that you saw the police do over there?
I could say it was one officer that we all know. And it was a little kid named Simi over there, man, that was having brain cancer, and he was dying. He only had a certain amount of time to live. And I really didn't fuck with this officer because he talked too much, like I felt.
I think we know who that is.
And like when I first came back to the scene, after my vacation, and he didn't know who I was, so he's all the kind of trying to come talk to me. And I don't know. I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to talk to none of y'all. I don't have nothing to say, So his statement was, oh, we got to watch this guy. If they don't talk to the police, they up to something. No, I don't want to talk to the police. Yeah. I don't want to talk to you and nobody else. I'm literally just coming from doing the bid, So we don't have shit to talk about, But it's crazy because down the line, as it got so bad for him to where he had to go to the hospital and they keep him comfortable, I used to see this guy there probably 3-4 times a week crying like a fucking baby, bro. Literally. I'm talking about tears in this guy's eyes. Mm-hmm. And it fucked me up, man. Because I'm like, holy shit, like, this dude gives a fuck. So it kind of made me feel like, hey, maybe they all ain't so bad.
Right.
Right. So that was one of the moments right there that I was seriously reconsider that every officer is a bad officer.
Bobby D, he's I love the guy like a brother, man. He's got a fucking huge heart. And, taking care of the kid there and helping out. And he was
That's who he is.
Yeah, yeah. He was getting frustrated because he didn't do it for attention. He doesn't do shit for attention. He does it because that's who he is. And when it started gathering a little bit of attention, and, of course, the fucking... Once the brass gets a hold of the upper command staff, they want to fucking take pictures and take credit. And fucking Bobby was getting pissed off, And he's like, I'm not doing it for that, because he truly cared, And like you say, man, he'll talk you to death. He'll fucking absolutely sit there and talk you to death, man. But he's got a good fucking heart. We're getting older, man. We're getting older. Shit, some of the shit doesn't matter anymore. It's like, hey, man, let's just be fucking good people, man. And I don't think I ever ran into Bo there. I might have,
You mean on the streets?
On the streets, years ago, but like I said, the Pueblos wasn't my thing. I like being over on the east side, so we'd go over there when something would happen. But the first time I think we actually talked was over at the warehouse, yeah. You know? And part of that thing of getting older and you know, you fucking respect people no matter what until they fucking give you something to not respect them for.
It, just explain to me, first of all, like what led you to football and what do you love about the game?
Football is the best sport ever. It's the greatest team sport. I will argue anybody down.
How so?
You cannot win the game just with one player. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And everybody has to pitch it. If the O-line doesn't block for the quarterback ain't doing shit.
That's right.
You know, if the linebackers don't, you know, fill in those, like, nobody can do anything without the other person. And just, like, for me personally, football and contact sports, I think, for women are essential.
How so?
You know, as girls, we're not socialized to rough and tumble and roll around with people like boys are. But the act of hitting another person gives you a confidence over your body, your physical body, that I don't think you get in other ways, and that's important. Mm-hmm. You know, all the statistics show, even just sport, not just contact sports, but sports in general, girls that play sports are less likely to get sexually assaulted, you know, all of those things. But it gives you a power over your body that's, like, unmatched. Mm-hmm. And I don't, because I remember my first hit, right? Claudia Hogan hit me.
What was that? That was in pro football?
Yeah.
And explain that.
Oh, my God. So we had this blocking drill. And, like, you know, I was fast. Like, Claudia is, you know, as we always say, Claudia's raised by wolves. Yeah. And she, you know, we just had to block. And she hit me. And I was like, oh. I was like, okay. I think I know what I have to do now.
Yeah. And what is it? What did you have to do?
You have to throw yourself at another person.
Straight up.
And go for blood.
Yeah.
And then it's so fucking addictive.
Yeah.
And it just feels so good.
Tell me about you as a player.
My strength is I like to hit. But I didn't really get to play defense. I got to play kickoff team, which I loved, even though we would beat everybody like 75-0. And nobody likes a blowout except me, because I always got to go down and hit the person. but, they put me at receiver. I was fast. I had to learn the skill. I can run in a straight line. The other things take a little bit of practice. Mm-hmm. And so at first I could catch the ball, but I couldn't stay on my feet. So every time I caught the ball, it would fall. And then I got the hang of it. And I was still the shy Natalie. Like, and then one day in Erie, Pennsylvania, we were playing the team. And I think it was Brian Mitchell. He was like our honorary coach for that year or something.
Okay.
And he was like, put her on kickoff team.
Wow. And Brian Mitchell, legend.
Yeah. And he, because he make her the gunner. And I went down and I hit the girl, like, she just caught the ball and wow.
Yeah.
And then she started to cry.
Damn.
And I was like, I'm so sorry. And then it was just so wonderful. And every time we scored, I was like, yes, we scored. We're on kickoff, you know.
About to go hit somebody.
But it was everything I needed to pull me out of that shy, unconfident person that Sidwell had kind of created, you know. And it was learning how to be confident in your person.
But like, what made you, like, what was that decision in the first place? Why were you like, yo, I'm gonna try for a professional football team?
Because I loved football. I would watch it all the time. And I can't tell you why. I don't remember when I started liking football. I would just like watching it.
How did being a player influence you as a coach and vice versa? Like, how did it inform your coaching?
Well, the skills that I picked up, I tried to put onto, you know, the kids I was coaching. And then the other thing is that I knew one position, really, when they hired me.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, but you can organize. So I was the organizer, and I had to hire people who knew more.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started to learn. Mm-hmm. And I was a teacher.
Yeah.
I know how to teach kids.
Yeah.
I know how to teach people things.
Uh-huh.
And so football is just another thing that you teach.
The thing is, and like, obviously, like you've talked about, like there's such a fascination because it's a woman in football and football is what it is. And that now that's like just that's just starting to kind of like break through in a more major way. You're a pioneer there. But I guess like being a woman, how did that help if it did, and how did it make it harder?
I think it helped, hopefully, and you can ask Quinn this for his opinion. They respected me, you know, and they knew that I loved them, and the kids are always easy, right? It's the adults that give you most problems. Because kids just want to do well. And so if they see that you're about them and you're not bullshitting, because they have a very accurate bullshit meter, then they're fine. The adults have all the, preconceived everything and whatnot. And so I had more problems with adults than ever had with kids.
Problems that you would have had being a head football coach, period, or because you were a woman?
Because I was a woman.
I got hired on a Monday, 1987. I was a failed athlete. I had always planned on playing in the NFL.
Yep.
And then I never had a plan B. I never planned for anything other than that because that's what I was going to do. Well, it turns out, dude, you ain't good enough to play in the NFL, right? So now you're left like a lot of young people. Now what? Right? So at the time, this is mid-80s. Miami Vice was popular.
Yep.
And as an audience, we had never seen a cop show like that.
Right.
We had seen all the procedurals, detectives responding reactively to crime scenes, doing interviews, patrolmen, right? And then all of a sudden, Sonny Crockett shows up on the scene and
playing
he's
the
like,
role.
Got the Hugo Boss on, he's riding a Lambo around South Beach, right? And he's going into these mansions and he's meeting with these glamorous kingpins and there's a ton of cocaine out on some barge in the harbor. And he's got these like stripper models bringing him mojitos. Right. And I'm like, man, that seems pretty cool.
Yeah.
So the reality of it is what I found. The reality is that Lamborghini, it was like a beat down Monte Carlo.
Sure.
Right. And the Hugo Boss suit was like cut off camos and a wife beater T-shirt and flip flops.
Right.
The kingpin that Sonny Crockett was dealing with was some like broke dick dude who didn't have two nickels to rub together that was sitting at the end of the bar with his plumber's crack hanging out.
Right?
The ton of cocaine, it was an eight ball that was so stepped on with baby laxative you'd shit before you'd get high off of it. Right? And then the stripper models that like you see on TV that are like running with these cats, they're like straight skanks with like three teeth in their head and tits like sweat socks with rocks in the toes. And so when I experienced it, and it was so much different than what Hollywood had sold me on.
Sure.
I fucking loved it. Yeah. Every day, man. Every day I loved it. It wasn't glamorous.
Yeah.
Undercover work is a nasty, dirty, bloody, vomit-covered scab of a life.
Yep.
And when I realized that, I still loved it, man.
Yeah. And what was it that you loved?
I loved the challenge of it. I loved the competition of it. I loved how dirty it was.
Yep.
I didn't have to be the guy with the gold chains and the Rolex and all the driving the Ferrari.
Mm-hmm.
Like I didn't care. I'd show up like on a bicycle for deals. Ride a bike because that's how some of those cats roll.
How early in the career was that first event where you got wounded?
I get hired on a Monday.
Yeah.
Right. So I actually was out here in Los Angeles, got sworn in, and I told my supervisors, I want to work undercover. I came to work undercover.
Sure.
So supervisor digs in his desk and he hands me a cassette tape and some headphones. And all it said on it was Marty. Right. So I plug it in and I'm listening. What it was the audio recording of a Baltimore Police Department narcotics officer named Marty Ward.
Holy shit.
Who, Marty, in December of 1984, was in an undercover deal with a heroin dealer and was shot like five or six times point blank in a drug dealer's apartment. And Marty...
In Baltimore?
In Baltimore.
Uh-huh.
And Marty dies on tape. Marty dies with his boys trying to rescue him. You hear him die.
Wow.
Right? So
the guy shot him left and then you hear his backup unit come in trying to save him.
Yeah, and it's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard to listen to, right? Yeah. So I come out, I'm listening to tape. My boss is like, "Hey man, you still want to work undercover?" I'm like, "Yeah, man, this dude's a freaking hero. Like I'm not going to die doing it."
Right.
But right? So 4 days later, I get hired. I want to work undercover. They make me listen to the Marty tape. They're trying to like, "Hey, dude, you need to know what you're getting into, right?" 4 days later, I get taken hostage and shot. The bullet went in my back. It went in between my.
How did you get taken hostage?
So there's so many stories and backstories to everything, right?
I know.
So like I'm brand new, and like I haven't been to the academy. I don't have any training. I wasn't a street guy, right? So I'm like on the outer tertiary, like most distant perimeter of this arrest operation.
Sure.
The suspect shows up. He shows up on a motorcycle, gets off his motorcycle, parks in front of his house, starts walking in. Boom, boom, boom. All the units, all the surveillance units start swooping in on him to make the arrest.
Sure.
Well, he takes off. He takes off running. And so I'm in so far in the distance. Like I'm supposed to just be staying out of the work.
Right.
I see the cat running. Well, I start running.
Right.
So like I wasn't fast enough to play in the NFL. Right. I was slow
but
for the NFL.
D1 wide
but
receiver.
I was freaking yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was Usain Bolt in Copland, right? So I start like I'm passing dudes and chasing. We're running through the neighborhood, and he's serpentine and zigzagging, and I lose the dude. He vanishes. Yeah. He knows where he's at. I don't know where he's at.
Yeah.
Short time later. Like we're just kind of searching, creeping for the dude, and
Do you still have your guys around you, or
they're like we're all spread out,
staked out, okay,
distant, right? So everybody's like, you know, no one's really nearby or close, and the dude was hiding, man, and he popped up and drew down on me, and I had my gun, and he was like, motherfucker, I will fucking kill you where you stand, right? And I'm like, you know, I don't remember seeing this episode of Miami Vice,
right.
The dude gets behind me, puts the gun to my head.
And he puts his gun to your head, right? And he says, I'll kill you where you stand. Has anybody ever said that to you in your life? Had anybody drawn a gun on you before in your life?
No.
So now there's a gun at your head. What are you feeling, man?
Well, like I didn't have like those types of life experiences to refer back to. Like, okay, what do I do now?
Right.
But there is a sports element to it. There is a football element to it. Things are breaking bad. There's chaos. There's panic, man. You're losing the game. You don't help yourself by becoming hysterical.
Right.
You find your zen. You find a sense of calm, and you try to like let your computer run.
Where are you at this point mentally? Have you decided? You done with the gangs? Are you done with? Are you saying like, no, hey, look, I'm not going to live a life of crime anymore?
I come out and I come out respected now. I just did a bid on an attempted murder for the hood. You get me?
Yeah.
So, like, I'm coming back. I'm still engaged, but I'm coming back different.
How so?
When you come out of a prison mentality with these, and you're still involved in the neighborhood, you come not willingly or unwillingly, you're an enforcer now, right? You're like, hey, this shit ain't not, you know, you ain't playing. Like, and at that time, I'm getting into mad fights with the homies, right? Bam, like. Because that's it. Like, these last 3 years, I have been trained in fucking... We just been fighting, rioting, stabbing. Fighting, rioting, stabbing. That's it, baby. That's it. So, me taking off on you ain't shit to me right now, right? So, yeah, bro, I come out and I'm kind of that, you know? Like, but not enforcing it, but I'm a presence, right? I'm a presence. And I'm a presence for my little homies, and I'm a presence for the older homies. But I knew that I needed to do something different, and that was at Homeboys, bro. That was Father Greg right there.
I hate to harp on it, bro, but when you say that, like, you knew you needed to do something different,
right?
Was there something specific that happened that made you know? Like, and what different?
Yeah,
explain the difference,
bro. You know what? My son. I think the game changer was my son, bro. I remember that journey, right? Going to Palmdale, and I don't have no money. You know, I have to take the train to Palmdale. I can find his apartment. His mom left him, you know. We met his mom. She kind of did him dirty like that, you know. And I'm not gonna throw her under the bus, but she ain't around at that time. And his grandma's there, right? I knock on the door, and he's in the room. And then she was like, Adrian, there's someone here to see you. And like this little fucking little white complected little boy comes out, you know. He fucking little. He has like he has silver teeth at that time and shit. I was like, damn, my boy, what happened? Yeah. And he has a little G.I. Joe. And I remember he fucking, like, he just hands it to me, you know? And she's like, that's your dad. And then it was that, bro, you know? You're just like, fuck, like, I changed you, dog. You're like, fuck, like my dad wasn't there. And like, And like, here you are, like, you know, you love me and shit, but like, I gotta fix this shit, son. You know, I'm sorry, so I didn't know, but you just feel these emotions, you know, and I think that was the motherfucker right there, bro. Like, and I didn't know what I was gonna do, but I knew that I had to fucking be there, you know, because my dad left, bro. My dad left to fucking Texas, you know, like, and not having your dad makes a fucking difference, bro, you know? Not having your mom makes a fucking difference, but not having your fucking dad makes a difference, bro.
When you say you knew then that you needed to be there, what did be there mean? What did that encompass?
You know, bro, and, like, my mind could only grasp what it could grasp at that time. I knew that I couldn't leave you. That I wasn't gonna leave you, that I was gonna show up. That's it. That's all. I'm going to take you to McDonald's. All I got is enough money for McDonald's, my son, but I'm going to take you. That's it, bro. We overthink this shit. Fucking class, fucking psychology, therapy. Just fucking be there for your children, you dumb fucks. Be there. Love them. Listen. It's not complicated, homie. Right? That's it, bro. That's all I did, bro. That's all I did. He fucking is... And then I didn't stop, bro. Fucking was it not, bro? His mom fucked him up, you know? And I fucking, boom. Well, fuck, I'm going to be right here, son.
And that little boy is the boy that I met.
Little boy's the little, you know, grown up that, boy with the, you know?
And I tell you what, man, that, you know, because we, you know, we just, you know, had this beautiful, you know, artistic experience, man, where you know, and I met. Man. I met that boy, you know, and that's a love boy, man. Hey. He loves his dad, and that's a solid young man.
Yeah, bro, it was crazy.
You did your job, bro.
But she saved my fucking life, dog. Yeah. Like, before the kid, before the job, before fucking, before God, before any religion, before any, before a laugh, before Bo, before a phone, before anything, was this woman's face. And there wasn't no promises made, wasn't no long conversation being had, nothing. Just her presence, the ministry of presence. Sometimes that's all you need to offer a person who's in a situation like that, is like just to be present. And she was present for me at a time when I didn't deserve to have nobody in my life, especially her. And I'm not trying to do this boo shit, because right away my head goes to like, how's this being viewed? I'm such a fuck this way.
You're good. You, come on, man.
Yeah. She's a real one. She's a real one. In the, yeah. I'll never be able to. It's the first time I really understood love, because I didn't have nothing to give. And I was sitting there thinking like, well, I don't have nothing. It's not sexy to be with me. Don't you get it? Like, people out here accusing me of, like, putting makeup on my genitals and, like, shooting dogs and shit. Like, you know? That's what I'm being accused of. And you're showing up for me like you're going to be tied to this shit? Mm. It didn't make no fucking sense. Mm. And love is irrational that way. You can't rationalize real love. It doesn't make any fucking sense. And I had spent my whole life trying to rationalize it. Like, you know, this dude hits me up. He's in my corner because, you know, we fuck with the same craft. You know what I mean? That's what he loves this thing that I got, that I'm like, I'm G with this shit over here. That's why he loves me, because he loves that part of me that's G at this. Mm. You know, and then I would write your love off like, oh, okay, you love me because I do this shit. Mm. And so many of my relationships were basically like, you love me because I'm fucking sensei over here. In the dojo, I'm black belt right here. So you love me because of this. And when they blow the dojo up, you're like, I'm not G at nothing. I'm not sensei at nothing. I don't even know how to fish. I don't even know how to fucking do nothing. Like, I don't even know how to camp. I'm a fucking little kid. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I don't know how to make a fire. Mm-hmm. And, she gave me hope, bro, when I was really, like, running on fumes. I wasn't running on empty, but I was running on fumes. I'd had a sponsor in my life who was kind of, he was saying, yo, be patient. The shit will show up. Miracles will show up. This was another miracle. Yeah. Bags packed is a miracle. Yeah. You know, them laughing in the car is a miracle. My wife's face on the Skype call is a miracle. The shit starts to add up where, you know, it becomes this like, it creates faith because you're not doing it. It wasn't some fucking dope poem I sent or some flowers I sent that put her on a Skype call. And it wasn't good behavior or being a man. It wasn't good sex that got my wife on the Skype call. It wasn't like any of this self-will shit that I used to validate her being in my life. Like, even my sex life was like, it was so performative. It was like, well, if a woman didn't orgasm, I would question it. Mm-hmm. You know, like, what does this mean about me? Mm-hmm. It was always about me. I never had like a real coupling. It was always performative, and it was always like this constant validation trip. If I would try to look for the same shit I got at work over here in this relationship. Yeah. And the reason I didn't like being friends with men is it was constantly this comparison study. You know, and this has been difficult too, is to like reach back out to people who were in my corner then, who are still in my corner but are G's. It's hard to reach out to dudes like that because you knew them at a certain level. You know, another dude who really showed up for me was Cuddy. Like, he was the first friend that really hit me back, you know, like, and he's a fucking G. Dude is like, his life is on fire. And it's hard to, like, I've always known him at a certain kind of equivalency. We've always been to be in each other's lives is sort of like, you know, like I knew him at a level, mm-hmm. and I'm not at that level. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's difficult to like, to show up for the love, to show up for the love that people are throwing at you. Cause you think you're, you know, you think you are these Twitter comments. You think you are this idea what you, what, fuck, I gotta get out of this octave because I sound like boohoo bullshit. No, but
come on, being you, bro.
Yeah, but I don't want to be fucking performative for your shit.
Dude,
it's difficult for a dude in my spot to receive love because you don't feel like you deserve it. And so you wind up dipping on a lot of people, even when they're showing up for you. Mm-hmm. And then you got to have like real conversations. I had to really put it out there to him, like, bro, I don't feel successful enough to be your friend anymore. What a fucking like crazy shit to write, but you gotta air it out.
We met on a film set, but over the last 12 years, you know, besides, you know, my wife's sisters, like, you are the closest thing I have to a sister. And like, when I look at like our highs, our lows, we've bumped heads. We've come out of it.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, man, I'm just like really grateful for that. I'm really grateful for you. You've become a part of my life, my family's life, my network of friends. You're in that life, your family. And I think the one thing that I bet we agree on, it is the absolute number one best thing about what we get to do for a living, that it puts you in sort of a fertile field where those kinds of relationships mm-hmm. can flourish and can be generated. And it's my favorite thing about what we do.
It creates a staggeringly fast intimacy. It can. Do you know what I mean? And that set, Frank fostered it, and I think you and Andy and I all came into it together going, there's a way to do this where we all come out better people and better actors. And I don't know about you, but like, I'd come off of a show that was very different and had a very challenging environment and came out of it going, how do I consciously create a culture that brings everybody up and doesn't leave anybody behind?
And you did that. Like,
and
you,
we talked
you,
about that. Yeah. We all did that though.
Yeah, but you were the like force behind the culture of that show, making sure everybody, you know, we're all there in Georgia together, making sure everyone was looked out for, making sure
I think that was all three of us though, because there was kind of a zero tolerance policy for
assholery.
Yeah. You know, and Andy did his thing through like sheer force of will and leadership. Like, I am just going to so wholly devote myself to this path that one by one people are going to go, what's he doing? Oh, I should do that. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
And like, we all kind of had our little thing. And I think what was beautiful is that it worked because we chose to be devoted to each other.
Yep.
Do you know what I mean? Be like, I will make sure that you do the best work you can possibly do by giving you everything I can give you. And I mean, it's funny, I was just talking to Milo about this the other day. Like, if I do my job as an actor, I give you everything you need for your work.
That's right.
So that all you have to do is say your lines in the right order and not bump into the furniture.
That's right.
And then when I'm on camera, because, and that's the thing that I think sometimes people don't know, is I'm looking at you, but I'm looking behind you is a wall of lies. It's a wall of cameras and lights and grips and, you know, people on their phones doing other stuff. And that's how it's supposed to be. But the only real environment I ever see is when you're on camera. So I can play the truth because I see the truth.
Yeah.
The camera turns around and you're the only truth I've got.
That's right. That's
Everything right. else is a lie.
That's right.
Unless you're on one of those really cool shows, you know, and I gotta say, actually, Mikey and a lot of the guys on the show were great about like putting the cameras so fucking far away that it was a little different. But yeah, I mean, I will forever be a different actor for having worked experience. On that show. And a different person too, which is
too.
Part of why we're sitting here as friends, I think.
What was it about?
Made me sad.
And because people were like more concerned about like individual performance, or people were more concerned with what do you?
I think a couple of people just really didn't care, just decided that the show wasn't something that they cared about kind of early on and went through the motions. And I don't really know, you know, like there were a couple of people who were working their asses off and doing really cool work, and I would find them over the course of stuff, you know what I mean? Like I just finished a pilot with Bill Fichtner, and it's the same thing, and I was looking over and I was like, that's right. Anytime I would get lost in a scene, like look at Billy and Billy's telling the truth, you know?
And so you feel like with Walking Dead, it was just this perfect storm of great writing, great crew. I mean, like
great leadership, you know, like Frank showed up with his whole heart. And I think somebody said to me once, fish rots from the head down. I don't know if that's true. I don't eat fish, and I don't sit around and watch fish rot, but it sounds like it could be true. And it's certainly true on a set, right? Like, and Frank showed up and just went, here's my whole heart. It's in the words. It's in that, like, it was like a child. You know, I came early to just watch him direct because I was like, I can go to Frank Darabont Film School for free.
Right.
And he would be behind the monitor and he'd just be like,
yeah.
Yes, great, let's do it again. Okay. And he would run out to set and this big grin on his face. And like, you know, there was this just massive enthusiasm for what we were doing and a real faith. That's what it was, actually. Nobody ever looked down on the material. Mm-hmm. We were doing a zombie show.
Right, on fucking AMC.
At a time when AMC had ever done three shows, only two of them had succeeded, and they didn't have a hell of a lot of viewership. Like, right. It got there, but you know, Breaking Bad and Mad Men, they had like a million viewers or something. You know, like it wasn't, and it was a comic book back when like geeks had not yet run the world.
Right.
And that was a big difference too. Like on Prison Break, everybody was making fun of the material and rolling their eyes you know, changing and this scene is shit and whatever. And it was just like, oof, okay. But we all showed up for our own various reasons to go, what if we took this totally seriously?
Super seriously, that's it. What was that thing? It's like if you have seven people out in the woods running from fucking zombies, and if one person isn't taking it enormously fucking seriously, like you all look like fucking assholes. It was like that you know, it was like that can't be if you make any noise, you're violating the rules. Like they're out there and
right,
you know, you said everybody came to it with different you know, that was the other thing, you know, I just think about, you know, like kind of touchstones in our relationship. But you know, you just hit on it. Like I came to that show kind of lost. Like I came to that show not knowing, you know, who, if I wasn't the guy that was, you know, the craziest dude in the spot looking for trouble, like who the fuck was I?
Right.
And I had these amazing models with you and Andy of, you know, two young artists that were fucking incredible at what they did it with such sanctity and did it with such vitality and were so faithful to the work, but also enormously and equally, if not even more so, faithful to your families, to your spouses and to your kids. And like to be models of that, it really shaped the way that I looked at really the next 10 years of my life of trimming all the fat out and having these two components of like putting my faith. And I'm just like wondering, like, how was I to you back then? Like how, when you first met me and you saw this dude who was like, I think trying to explain, hey, I'm this guy, but I'm trying to be this guy. I imagine I was pretty lost. And whereas you guys, again, were sort of these beacons of like people who I felt like had it figured it out. I'm wondering what that was like for you guys. Not just about me, but maybe just in terms of going to that show in general.
You know what was interesting is, like, the first conversation we had on the phone, I was like, oh, Jesus. Like, you were like, all right, girl, I'll come pick you up, rock and roll. And I was like, who is this fucking white boy? Like, what in the name of God?
Where, like, you have this lived experience out in the real world where there may be one other person on the set, if anybody, who has that shared experience that you had, yet all these people are trying to recreate a reality that, frankly, only you know. Does that make you this just like, do you have to just say eventually, like, I gotta let it go because they can't get it exactly right? Or how do you process through that when you're working?
That's a great question. And I'll say it this way. The difference, so, you know, I've brought in several people into the industry, military people that I was like, hey, you know, they were interested, or I was just trying, hey, you know, whatever. And I've had them be advisors, and then that happens to where they can't adjust to the process of how film is made. It has to be this way. Doesn't have to be anyway. Anything I was advising was never about advising the military. It was creating the art. And it's like I say on the show that I work on now, here's the key. You could spend all day dealing with details, like extras, background. Fucking patches are on upside down. You could spend all day on that shit. But if John's on camera, you're gonna notice if he has a zit before you're gonna notice if the background has a helmet on or off, right? So you gotta put the time and effort into what matters. And what I always try and tell people is, I go, look, if the emotion's there, if it's connecting with people, they won't notice any wrong details. And if they notice any wrong details, you've already fucked the whole story anyways. Totally. Doesn't matter.
Totally.
So now, granted, best case, you get the story right and try and do all the details you can, but it comes down to, are you telling a story that's connecting with people? And I've always tried to focus on getting that connection right and telling stories that people are gonna go, I identify with that, I've experienced that, or I know a buddy that's experienced that. And then everything else, you know, you work hard at, and it all just falls in place.
And also, man, I would imagine it's like so much of it also is like personnel and who you're surrounding yourself with. But I mean, I think there's a reason why fucking, you know, like David Ayer has Kevin Vance and fucking, you know, fucking Spielberg and Oliver Stone used Dale Dye. It's like, you know, you have guys like yourself that are coming in that's not just, hey man, you hold a weapon like this, that they're instilling how sacred this is, that like what this means to them, that what this has cost them, friends that have died over there that they've seen, and that like you should want to have your fucking patch fucking right because they're fucking there, and like understand that this is about something so much more important than you in the movie. And I think on the sets that I've been on where it's really worked, you know, number one, you get actors where the first person they're actually listening to is the person who's been there. Like that's who's sacred. That's who you tread. That's who you follow anywhere. And, you know, good directors, I think, you know, remove their ego from that and say, hey dude, fucking, that's the guy. Like, let's go. You know what I mean? Yeah. And that's why those relationships then are forged kind of forever. And look, I think there are some soldiers, I imagine, that like will never understand how to get beyond themselves, never understand how to work with that kind of autonomy. Maybe they'll always be sort of okay for the hammer, but never for the sickle. But, and there's certain actors that like will never get out of like, hey man, like what looks coolest? Like, how do I, what's going to be the biggest moment for me? Not like, hey, what's the most honest? What would you do here psychologically where I'm at? And it's like marrying the two. But I found that there's such fucking art, there's such fucking communication in the technical advice, like in getting that shit technically right.
Everything isn't righteous, but everything that I've been lucky enough and blessed enough to work on up until this moment has been necessary.
Fuck yeah.
You know, sometimes, because righteous is such a such a personal, it's a personal thing.
You're like, the only one who can answer it.
Some shit might be righteous to him, but I might be like, yo, man, I don't feel like watching The fucking Office. You know what I'm saying? I fuck with The Office, but it's not righteous. So, yeah. but it is though.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So it's like, I don't kind of look at it like that, but I more so look at it through the lens of things that I think are meaningful based on the people who I've been lucky enough to interact with.
One of the things you and I also first connected on, it's like somebody can come at something with something that fucking has deep fucking meaning for them, man, that they really, really care about, but then they hand that over or they get marginalized within the process very fast because there's people who have been there before, people who know more, or people, and then it just becomes something else and fit into a box of familiarity. And I think familiarity is like a huge, huge enemy in this shit, man. Like, you gotta steer clear from that. Like, write the fucking truth, write your truth, and you gotta eliminate, I think, so many of the middlemen. I mean, you can't have middlemen in this thing. You just can't.
We can talk about intentions, we can talk about people that have good hearts, we can talk about people that wanna do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And we can't demonize them for that. However, we can still demonize the system in the way that they chose to exercise that action without calling them bad people or picking them apart. These are the problems that exist. It's like shit that has just been in line before all of us were born. Right. And we're chasing that. And we're trying to solve it using the same thing that we've been trying to use for hundreds of years. And the shit just doesn't really work. And it's not even it's not even their responsibility to understand that shit. So it's kind of like we can't even judge them the way that a lot of them are judged, because they don't even have the experience, the skill set, or the insight to really understand that.
100%.
But they do have a skill set and insight that is valuable based on the lives that they led, and that shit is valuable too.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like, even like if you talk about the show that we just worked on,
yeah,
no writer in the history of fucking writing has ever articulated the problem with society, politicians, police officer, and culture better than David did in the book, The Corner. The book, The Corner, is so fucking nuanced that, like, a person with a limited amount of reading comprehension could pick that book up and understand why shit doesn't work. Why the shit that we do doesn't work, right? It doesn't work. How he remains optimistic after writing that is some wild shit, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's some wild shit, but it's a perfect example of when we talk about what that why is. And the why for me, and what I see in a lot of projects, a lot of things that I work on, it becomes just this whole idea of, let's hold a mirror up and let's just identify what's happening. And let's show why these things play out the way they play out. But let's be entertaining and let's be fun. And let's get into some shit. Let's get dirty. But at the same time, let's tell the hard truths.